In with about 20 scouts and food over here and everything, but we felt really good about the draft. You know, it was an incredibly important few days for us. You know, strategically we stockpiled a lot of picks to make sure we had as many chances as possible to hit the bullseye, and we felt very good about it. Our first pick was Corey Spangenberg. He was a guy really all spring. He was a targeted guy. Kind of an interesting story. He transferred from VMI, Virginia Military Institute. He had kind of unrecruited at a high school from a really small town in Pennsylvania. Went to VMI, led the team in hitting, was a conference freshman of the year. Went to his summer league, the Valley League, which is a Wood Bat League. Was MVP of that league, led the conference in hitting, and I think a combination of not wanting to be in military school anymore and wanting to get drafted a year earlier, he decided to transfer to Indian River. And we had a couple scouts go in there for the first weekend of the year. We had a couple of scouts go in to watch him, and the reports were unbelievable. And it was sort of out of nowhere. You weren't expecting him to be a first-round kid, and right away they put him in the first round. And we just kept sending guys in over and over. To be honest with you, when the year started out, we thought he'd be an ideal guy for us to take it at number 25. He's exactly what we're looking for. He's a well above average runner, almost a top of the scale runner, and a pure hitter, a guy that can hit singles, hit doubles, doesn't strike out much, really controls the strike zone. And we thought that'd be perfect for us to get at 25. And sort of as the spring went on, really over the last couple of weeks, it became very clear to us that we didn't take him number 10, and we weren't going to get him. He's either going to go number 12 to Milwaukee, number 14 to Florida, or number 15 to Milwaukee again. So once we knew there was no way he was going to get back down to us at number 25, it became a really good debate among him, Archie Bradley, who went number 7 to Arizona, and Francisco Lindor, who went number 8 to Cleveland. And those really are our three guys that we talked about over and over at number 10. And, Cleveland and Arizona made that decision really easy for us. They selected the other two guys, and so we were very happy to get Corey at number 10. We think he'll move quickly through the system. And one of the best things is he signed right away. His agent was very clear that he was going to go out and play right away. And hopefully getting this full or half season under his belt will allow him to move very quickly. Last year, to kind of compare him to one of our players in our minor league system, I think a lot of times players that don't sign until August really miss out. Jed Jerko, who's, I think he's hitting .385 for us right now at Lake Elsinore, he signed the first day last year, and he's going to find himself in Double-A really quickly in his first full professional season. Most guys that wait until August don't have that opportunity. So it's a little bit underrated how important it is to get guys out and playing right away. And Corey will be up in Eugene to start the season here next Saturday. Our second pick was at number 25 was Joe Ross. Joe is the brother of Tyson Ross, who pitched at Cal. I think he was a second rounder, and now he's in the Oakland A's rotation, or he was. He's actually on the DL right now. Tyson is about 6'6", 6'7", and Joe is about 6'4" right now, and most people think he's going to end up growing late like his brother and end up really just being a huge individual. Jason McLeod, this was our area scout in Northern California, Noah Jackson, from day one was pounding the table about Joe, talking about how he's kind of the rare combination of a guy that has, throws 95 miles an hour now, has a good curveball, has terrific mechanics, but also has some projectability left. There's no reason to think he won't continue to get better. And Jason McLeod went up there to see him twice and really fell in love with him. So he was really, hoping that he would fall down to us at number 25, and he did. So we're really excited to get him. Now, we haven't signed him yet, but we're very optimistic that that we'll be able to sign him. Noah Jackson, our scout, had a very good relationship with him. I know the family wants him to play on the West Coast, so I think we have a little bit of an advantage. And it's actually interesting. I know that the two players that Cleveland was considering at the number 8 pick in the draft were Francisco Lindor and Joe Ross. So, right after the draft, I mean, I got a call from the people in Cleveland that said, I can't believe you guys got him 25th. We were going to take him 8th. So that always makes you feel really good. Our third pick, our first comp round pick was a pitcher named Michael Kelly. Kelly was actually a guy that we thought would go very high in the first round coming into the year. He throws 95, 96 miles an hour. That was one of the best guys last summer. Very heavy ball. Gets a lot of ground balls. He struggled a little bit out of the gate this year. When scouts went into Florida early in the year, he struggled. And this is a pretty common trend that happens is all the teams are in Florida for spring training. And if a player in Florida struggles early in the spring, they get moved down the draft boards. And if they play really well, they get moved up. And all the teams leave Florida, and there's a whole country to cover. So teams don't go back into Florida that much after spring training. So we sent a bunch of people back into Florida late, and Kelly was pitching the way he did last summer, 95, 96. He looked very good. So we're hopeful that any mechanical issues he had early in the year behind him, but we were very excited. He was actually on our first round board if Joe Ross didn't get to us at number 25. So the fact that we got him at number 48 was exciting. Our fourth pick was Brett Austin. Brett's a catcher. We're going to work with him a lot on his defense. His defense is the kind of crudest part of his game. But we absolutely love his bat. He's a switch hitter. Very good swing from both sides. Put up just incredible numbers this year in his league in North Carolina. I think he had 14 homers and struck out only twice during his senior year. And we had him ranked one of the best bats in the draft, and we were excited to get him where we got him. He does need to do some work on his catching, but if the catching doesn't come, he's athletic enough to probably play a corner outfield position. He runs well enough to do that. But most of all, we were excited to get a good switch hitting bat with power. And in this day of baseball, there's not much offense, frankly. Anyone that can hit is a huge plus. I know that we've struggled to score runs as a team this year, and that's something we have to fix, but it's also something that's actually an issue all around baseball right now. There's no offense in baseball, period. It's not just in San Diego. If you look at it since 2004, the average slugging percentage in the major leagues has dropped by 50 points. That's in a 7-year period for slugging percentage to go down that much. So finding hitters in the draft was a huge priority. There's not that many hitters in the draft. There's not that many hitters in the minor leagues. There's not a lot of good hitters in the big leagues right now. So if you can hit, you have a coveted asset, and that's something we focused on quite a bit. Our last selection on the first day was Jace Peterson. Jace is another guy that our scouting staff was really focused on. He's a left-handed hitting shortstop. And he's just an incredible athlete. He played in the secondary on the football team from McNeese State. So he's a little bit more raw than most college players. We look at that as a huge positive because he is just a top of the scale athlete, top of the scale runner. He's strong, but he hasn't played summer baseball. He's always been, getting prepared for football, lifting weights, and in football practice. So our hope is that once he goes out and focuses on baseball full time, that he'll really take off. And already he's performed very well at McNeese State. He's got a very nice swing. He's got good actions at shortstop. But that kind of athlete, we hope that once he gets full time baseball reps, he'll really take off. And he already signed as well, so he'll be along with Corey. He'll be in Eugene. And then lastly, the one pick I was going to kind of focus on in the second day was our first pick, Austin Hedges. I don't know if any of you guys are from Orange County, but he goes to Junipero Serra in Orange County. And, we have a lot of catchers on our staff. Brad Osmus is on our staff, A.J. Hinch. Brent Maine's actually our area scout in the Los Angeles area. So we probably have about 50 years of Major League experience, or at least 40 years of Major League experience among those guys, not to mention our scouting staff. And to a person, they felt like he was by far the best amateur defensive catcher they'd ever scouted. Just incredible actions, runs the game like a major league catcher. And we took him with our first pick in the second on the second day. He had fallen a little bit in the draft because his commitment to UCLA is pretty strong. But we're going to make every effort we can to sign him. And I know he's excited to be drafted by the Padres. I don't think there's a lot of teams that he would consider. But I think his family is excited about Southern California. And our scouts did a great job with him. I know the dad's favorite player is Brad Ausmus, and that should help us. So anyway, I think that he's an exciting prospect for us because he's, like I said, you don't usually hear superlatives like that in the draft room. Usually there's a lot of shades of gray. It's rare when a bunch of people stand up and say they've never seen a defensive catcher like that at that age. So we're excited to get him signed and get him in a Padre uniform as well. So that really sums up our first six picks. After the sixth selection, we really focused on taking arms. The one thing in the draft, once you get into like this kind of third, fourth, fifth round and beyond, I just really believe at that point in the draft, take power arms. I think that's how you can hit on a good bullpen. That's how you can hit on guys later in the draft. Not a lot of good offensive players come from the later part of the draft. But you can find a lot of good pitchers, and that's something we talk about a lot. Is just making sure we get guy after guy that throws in the mid 90s, good body, and give our player development staff something to work with. So guys like Andrees and Hebner and Pope, those are examples of guys that have good arms. They pitch well in college, and we're hopeful that we can hit on a couple of guys like that in the later rounds. So that really sums up our draft. It's wonderful to have that many picks, and we're excited to get those guys into our system. Overall, our system has been performing really well this year. So far, I think Jed Jerko is right now probably the MVP of the Cal League at High A. He was in last year's draft. I think he's hitting about .385 with 29 doubles. I think he's got 14 homers already. At Double A, James Darnell is probably the MVP of the Texas League. And Rizzo was certainly the MVP of the PCL before he came up. So we're having a lot of great offensive performances in the minor leagues, and hopefully that bodes well for these guys coming up here and having success in Petco. So I guess with that, I'll open up to questions. And Jared, are you moderating? Okay.
Actually, before we open it up, I'd like to turn it over to our team president, Tom Garfinkel. We wanted to have an opportunity to address all of you as well, and we'll have Tom join Jed on stage afterwards, and we'll open it up to questions. So, Tom, thanks for being here.
Well, I just listened to you for 45 minutes. How's everybody doing today? Anybody get a chance to go down to Player Photo Day before you came up? Okay. Try to do it so you can do both, but it was fun. There's a lot of players down the field. Probably had a couple thousand people down there taking pictures. But Rizzo was down there. Saw a lot of Rizzo t-shirts in the crowd today. That's good. We actually sold more Rizzo t-shirts. Our leading t-shirt up to this point this year was Heath Bell. And we sold more Rizzo t-shirts in the last 2 days than we did Heath all year. So I'm not going to tell Heath that. But no, Anthony's a great kid. He's a great young man. He's been through some things in his life that have, I think, risen him to a level of maturity probably well beyond where I was when I was 21. I can say that pretty fairly. And I wasn't a mess up at 21, but this young man is a pretty special character as well as a big bat. One of those he's going to connect on and hit a 5-run home run. I'm not sure. A couple of those swings, man. I think the catcher looked at him and went like this. Welcome. Thank you for being here today, and thank you for your support of the team. We can't grow this into the franchise and the that we want to grow it into, and the one that we want everybody in San Diego to be proud of, without your support. So we appreciate all your support, and we're working hard to try to have these kind of forums. To communicate, the decisions that we're making, why we're making them, and also to hear your comments and your thoughts about what we can be doing better. And we've tried to open up that dialogue a lot over the last couple of years,
and act on those things, and the things we can't act on, explain why we can't, and the things that we can, try to act on them, because this is your team, this is San Diego's team, and that's kind of how we approach it and how we look at it. And if we're going to make this, again, a franchise that everybody can be proud of in San Diego, we're going to need your input and your feedback as well. And trying to focus a lot on affordability, on service. We've got dedicated service reps now that all of you have. In fact, I just ran into a season ticket holder out in the park, who shared with me that he's going to the games in Boston, and that Mike Halley, his ticket services rep, was able to, he said he's thrilled because he got tickets behind home plate that he wouldn't have been able to get otherwise if he didn't get them through Mike. So, you know, it's those kinds of services that we want to provide so that if you want to go see the team. You know, we're spending our money on players, not on signs. So, you know, we're going to have that happen once in a while. But we've got Anthony Rizzo and players like, you know, Austin Hedges coming up. So, thank you, Jed. Appreciate that. And that's the other thing. You know, the team, the employees here, you know, no one's afraid to pick up the broom and sweep the floor, regardless. Regardless. Yeah, that's a present for somebody. Want to autograph that, Jed?
Yeah.
So now you know the real reason he did. Now when they take the photographs, he'll have a nice SD behind him, and I'll look like I'm, you know, backstage somewhere. With that, I'll turn it over now for questions and answers. But again, just want to reiterate how much we appreciate your support and thank you for that. And we look forward to having a dialogue with you now. Thank you.
Jed, besides just experience and age, what factors do you use to assess where these new draftees, once they're signed, go to play, whether it's low A or Peoria? How do you make those decisions and what factors do you use?
Sure. You know, for the most part, we send the college guys to Eugene. We send the high school guys to Peoria. You know, this, even with, and, you know, Corey Spangenberg is a very advanced hitter. We don't think he's going to have much problem in Eugene. He'll probably wind up at Fort Wayne, I would think, fairly quickly. But we always like to start every college guy at Eugene at the same place, get to know the guys he was drafted with. And we do the same thing with the high school kids. You know, once they get into the system and start playing, then their performance dictates what happens. But for the most part, that's a general rule, is Eugene for the college guys and Peoria for the high school guys.
Hey, good afternoon, guys. Thanks for hosting this event. This is a lot of fun. I'm Sean Meehan, season ticket holder. It's my wife, Sophia. With regard to, you know, offense being at a premium, are you guys looking at defense as an important role when you're scouting players? Particularly outfield defense, do you have a metric that judges a guy's break on a ball off the bat and things like that? I think outfield defense is going to be a critical component, especially here at Petco with the San Diego Padres. Thank you.
No, good question. You know, when it comes to outfield defense, we have a few proprietary ways to look at outfield defense in the minor leagues. Frankly, it's really difficult. We spent a lot of time working on that and trying to figure out how to do it. You know, when you're looking at outfield defense, there's a lot of factors that go into it. For example, if you're trying to grade out a left fielder, you know, how good a center fielder is plays a big role, because a center fielder is stealing balls from him, and therefore you can wind up, you know, looking at a left fielder that looks terrible, but the reality is all the reason he looks terrible is the center fielder is good. And that can happen in many different ways. You know, the sort of atmospherics of a ballpark, you know, it's hard to look like a really good outfielder in Tucson, you know, because the ball is just going over your head really quickly. It's very easy to look good in a ballpark that's big and, you know, the ball kind of sits up. So it takes a long time, a lot of thought to do it right. You know, defensive metrics are hard. I'll give you an example. In the Tim Hudson deal, when the A's traded Tim Hudson to Atlanta, a big part of that deal was an outfielder named Charles Thomas. And the reason they made that deal was he had off the charts defensive numbers. They were like, just looked like the best left fielder in the game, and it turned out it was all a charting error that, you know, and the trade, it ended up just fine. They, you know, they did well in the Mulder deal for Heron, so all, you know, it sort of all worked out for Oakland. But, you know, that's the thing, those are the things you have to be really careful of. A lot of Derek Jeter's negatives as a shortstop are more based on the charting in Yankee Stadium than they are based on reality. So it's really, it's a hard thing to do. You have to be very careful when you make too big a judgment based on defensive numbers. And you have to use your scouts quite a bit when it comes to looking at defense. There's a thing right now, if you go on MLB.com, MLB TV, they'll have like the hit effects and pitch effects when you can see the break of the ball and the velocity and the sink and all those things. They're supposed to come out with like what they call field effects, which is sort of the next generation of that, where they kind of see where every player starts, and then they can really grade the jump and all those things. They've been talking about that for a while. It's an incredible undertaking, and they're not there yet. I think once that happens, defensive metrics will go to a whole nother level. But until that happens, we're probably going to have to be dependent upon our own proprietary stuff. As for defense in this ballpark, there's no question it's really important. I mean, even just watching last night's game, I mean, the Nationals hit line drives all over the ballpark, and it was still a 2-1 game because, our defense played well. We ran under the ball. So I think it's a challenging thing to run out below average defenders in this ballpark. Admittedly, we're taking a small risk with Brad Hopp in the outfield right now. But we feel like it's an educated risk we have to take because we're not scoring runs. The Giants did the same thing last year with Pat Burrell. They put him in the outfield because they had to get offense, and it worked out well. So it's an educated risk, but one we think we need to do right now. But as a rule, I agree, we need to have good defenders.
I just want to say something, too, that sort of what you just heard from Jed is, there's a lot of talk in the last decade or so about, sort of money ball and how you evaluate players in baseball and how you do these things. And I think what you heard from Jed is sort of the unique perspective where, having been around a lot of GMs and see how they make their decisions and a lot of baseball folks, and there's a spectrum. On one end is you just look at a spreadsheet and make your decision about a player. You don't even have to see him, play. And on the other end is a guy that doesn't know how to turn on a computer and sort of instinctively. In fact, there was a former GM who I was talking to on draft day a few years back who, was talking about a player who had been hurt, who the team had picked higher than other teams thought he should go. And so why do you think that, or actually the player was going to fall because other teams weren't going to take him because of the injury. And this particular team thought the kid was going to recover from the injury really quickly. And I said, well, what information do you have that makes you more confident that the kid's going to recover from the injury? And the guy said, well, Tom, when you're looking at a kid recovering from injury, you want to look at the kid's parents, especially the mom. And in this case, real big bone mama, this kid's going to be just fine. It's a true story. So that's one end of the spectrum. The other end of the spectrum is, guy just looks at his computer, doesn't come out of his office and even watch a baseball game and says, that's the player. And I think, both are really important. The 30 years of baseball instincts and the scouts that can look at players and, I don't know if there's truth to the kid's mom, but maybe there is something there, who knows. But, and the statistics matter, but you have to be able to go up and down the spectrum to Jed's point about, the charting was wrong, they got the wrong player. And I think what you heard from Jed is, this unique ability that I've seen time and again in being able to go up and down that spectrum effectively and not live on either end, and really use all the information available to him well. And so, Jed and his team are doing a great job and watching the process and the draft. If the process is right in terms of, the debate, anybody see 12 Angry Men in the movie or the play or read the play? It's kind of like that's what happens in draft rooms for weeks leading up to the draft often. The groupthink takes over depending on who's got the loudest voice or who's – and that's not what happens here now because Jed and Jason and Jaron sort of facilitate a process where they stay focused on the objective and the evaluation of the player in an objective way and the information that's coming in and moving up and down that spectrum and valuing both ends of it. And that's why I'm confident, we got the right players and that, we're going to continue to grow our farm system in a way that is significant. That's the most important thing, we're doing, frankly, as an organization right now is draft day is like Christmas morning. So, but we have, what you saw in Jed, what you just heard from him is that unique ability that to go up and down that spectrum where a lot of his counterparts are living on either end. And so we're very lucky to have Jed here.
I'd like your opinion on a couple of college pitchers that I think kind of fell this year, didn't have as good of years as they did the previous season, that I think are steals, and that's Pope and Quackenbush.
Sure. Well, Pope, yes, frankly, we thought he was going to go much higher than he did. Now, he injured his oblique at the ACC tournament, and I think that might have been why he fell to the fifth round. I mean, to me, an oblique injury is one of those things where it's just not that big a deal. It's going to be, you know, 6 weeks off, and he's going to be fine. It's not an arm injury. So we were, yeah, like I said, we were very surprised. You know, we took, you know, Hebner was really the pitcher that he was sort of the sleeper in the room. Our guys loved him up to 97, a little bit of a Lincecum type delivery. And when we took him in the fourth round, we were really excited to get him there. We were kind of bummed out that we probably weren't going to get Pope. And then we were really shocked he was still there in the fifth round. And then Quackenbush has just dominant numbers. You know, as a closer in college, and you know, that's really, like I said, I mean, to me, you know, once you get past the early picks, just arm after arm after arm, and if they don't end up being starters, that's okay. They can populate the bullpen. You know, it's a risky thing to go outside the organization to try to fill your bullpen. There's nothing more volatile in baseball than relievers. And if you look at, I mean, look at the Yankees, for example. You know, Jabba Chamberlain needs Tommy John. They spent $36 million on Rafael Soriano. He's injured. And, you know, if it wasn't for Rivera, they'd really be in a lot of trouble. So it's hard to buy a bullpen. You need to build it from inside the organization. And, you know, by taking all those power arms later in the draft, we hope that we can accomplish that.
Philosophically, I'm curious how you value high school kids versus college kids. College kids, at no cost to you, are further along, further developed. You don't have to pay for that development. You know their maturity better. A high school kid may have much higher upside, but there's a lot lower downside. And they've got the option of going to college, sure. Like the catcher.
Michael, yeah, I mean, I look at it really almost exactly like a stock portfolio. You know, you don't want a portfolio of, you know, tech stocks, and you don't want a portfolio of all bonds. You know, I think you have to live on both of those. You know, one factor, I mean, I think all things being equal, I certainly prefer college players. They're further along. They've failed, which I think is a really important thing. That when you look at high school players' numbers, they all hit 500. You know, they all, I mean, these are the best players in their state, not even the best players in their town. And you never know what's going to happen when a player fails and how they're going to react. Every player has failed once they've gone through college because of the talent and the competition is better. So you get a chance to watch those players make adjustments. The players are further, they're three more years advanced without being hurt, which is important. And I think, you know, college is a good maturation time, and I think that you can watch how a player reacts to, you know, being away from home and those things. But at the same time, you know, there's a lot more talent in high school. You know, and I think especially now, the way the draft is being run now, teams are able to sign a high school kid for $1.5 million in the 10th round. Over the last 5 years, that's really taken a lot away from college baseball. And when you listen to scouts talk right now, their general feeling is that college baseball is at a pretty low point historically. So, you know, I think having a college-only philosophy right now would be detrimental because you wouldn't be getting the highest talent. So, like I said, we try to balance it out, take some college players, take some high school players, and understand when you look at a draft, obviously every time you make a selection, you hope that guy's going to be a big leaguer. At the same time, you also have an understanding that that's not the reality. That in the baseball draft, it's a huge war of attrition, basically, and you hope that you can get three or four big leaguers out of every draft. And if you do that, you're way ahead of the game. So you try to, you know, kind of mitigate your risk. You know, take some safer college players, take some high risk high school players, and really look at it kind of balancing your portfolio without going too strong on either side. Oh yeah, that's a good point, Tom. You know, the baseball's collective bargaining agreement is up in December, and there's going to be changes to the draft, and I think there's a very good chance they put a slotting system in similar to what basketball or football has, where, you know, every single pick has a number that you can sign a player for. The consensus around baseball is that when they do that, A lot more high school kids are going to go to college because there's not going to be as much money in it for them anymore, unless they're a very high pick. So I think college baseball is going to get a lot better over if that happens over the next 10 years or so. But it also means this was like this might have been the last year to take those high impact college high school players and pay them. So that was part of our thinking with some of our high school players we took is this is probably the last time we can do this going forward. I think it'll be a lot more college players, but I also, you know, it should be a slotted draft, and that means, you know, the high school kid's not going to get $1.5 million in the 10th round anymore, and that will really increase the quality of college baseball.
I was curious. I know what the press guys say, and I don't know what my fellow gas lamp ballers say. What do you guys think as far as how many of these guys do you hope to see in a Padres big league uniform to consider this draft successful, either directly or indirectly through subsequent trades to get other players?
Sure.
And on a time frame?
No, that's a good question. I mean, I always think about it. If you can get three or four contributing big leaguers out of a given draft, you've probably done very well, especially if those players have impact. I mean, you know, I'd like to think that a lot more than three or four of those players on that list will end up being in the big leagues in some capacity. But you hope to get three or four guys on that list that have an impact in the big leagues and have a you know sustained career, you know, 3 years or more, a starting type player, a rotation pitcher, that kind of thing. If you can get that many, like I said, you're way ahead of the game. When you look back at drafts, go back and like flip through the draft almanac and look at a team's 50 drafted players, and if you can see three or four players names that you recognize on that list, they had a really good draft. And like I said, that's why every selection is really important as you go down. You know, there's going to be injuries, poor performance, all those different things, and you just hope that you can wind up with three or four. And I sort of look at that from a farm system basis. If we can get to the point where we're producing, you know, maybe a rotation pitcher and one or two players every year out of the farm system to come up here and start, if we can get to that point, then I think we're a very successful farm system, and we should be a very stable organization. And that's our goal, is to get to the point where every year we bring up a guy like a Rizzo, you know, a pitcher like a Latos, that kind of thing, to be here. And if we can do that, now all of a sudden you're not relying on free agency, you're not relying on external factors. The best organizations have one or two guys come up every year, so we need to get to that point where we can do that. We're not there yet. We haven't been there for a while, but if we get to that point, I think we'll feel really good about our future.
This is kind of a Petco Parks special question. What percentage, or do you put any importance to a guy that can hit line drives rather than, you know, they try to hit home runs every time? You got Tony Gwynn on one end, and then on the other end, I don't want to call any names, but a lot of those guys can't put it over a wall.
Yeah, I mean, Tony Gwynn's a dangerous comparison. You know, you might wait another 100 years before you end up with Tony Gwynn again, so, you know.
No, but I mean, somebody is more of a line drive hitter than a guy that swings well.
Sure. Well, that was the biggest appeal of Corey Spangenberg, was he's a really pure hitter, hits line drives, uses the whole field. I think you're exactly right that as far as building a team for this ballpark, it's not that much different, I don't think, than thinking about how you look at the draft from high school and college. You know, we need guys that don't strike out. We need guys that hit line drives, but you're going to need a couple of guys that can hit home runs. I mean, you can't put together a team of just line drive hitters. You're going to have a couple guys when you go on the road that can hit homers. But I do agree that guys that can use the whole field and spray line drives in this ballpark are going to be really effective. And you know, currently we don't have enough of those guys, and you know, we need to create that through the farm system.
How many of your picks are represented by Scott Boras, if any?
Just one. Austin Hedges.
That was my fear, is that it's with Austin. So my gut is that you're going to have to pay more than you're going to be more up at the top end of the draft towards your number one guy than you are at a number two slot.
Yeah, you know, I don't think there's any question that, you know, if we're going to sign Hedges, we're going to have to be aggressive financially. He does have leverage. You know, he's a guy that was probably one of the 20 top. He's probably one of the 20 best players in this draft from a talent standpoint. So, you know, when we took him, we were aware of that, and we certainly hope we can do it. I mean, he's actually the first Boras client that I've either signed or drafted since I've been here. I do think a fear of Scott Boras is something that you have to be careful with. I mean, he has a lot of great players. In general, his players could price themselves out of this market. But at the same time, with Hedges, we felt like the risk of that is certainly worth the reward.
How many of the people out of these 49 on here do you expect that you'll actually end up signing? And do you pay any attention to local talent? I notice you've got two from San Diego, one from the university, and one from Torrey High Pines.
Sure. We'll hopefully sign a great number. We do take some players in later rounds. We call them draft and follows. High school kids that we'll take. We'll watch them over the summer, and if they really impress us, we'll decide to sign them. The draft currently is far too long. I'm really hopeful that in the next CBA they'll shorten it down to maybe 20 rounds. It used to be unlimited, and then they shortened it to 50 rounds. But they put a rule in about 4 years ago that eliminated what we used to call the draft and follow from junior college. They used to be able to take a junior college kid and sign him. You could follow him and end up signing him the next spring. Like Matt Latos is a good example of that. But you can't do that anymore. So as a result, once you get past like the 30th round, our farm system's already full. So at that point, we basically take high school kids that we want to watch over the summer. So there'll be a number of those kids we won't sign. That's not doesn't mean we missed on them. It means that we probably chose not to sign them, though they didn't impress us enough. But we certainly can't sign 50 players. We don't have enough room in our farm system. The second part of your question. What was the second part of the question? I forget.
Local.
That's a big priority for us. We need to have local talent. I always say to myself, Steven Strasburg, he was a San Diego high school kid that wasn't drafted by the Padres. Other teams had pretty good reports. We need to do a better job of not missing on local talent here. At the same time, it hasn't been a bumper crop for high school players here the last 2 years, which is rare. Usually San Diego has a number of high school first-round picks every year because it's among the best amateur baseball in the country. The last couple years haven't been quite as strong, but we do hope that we can get to the point where we're always taking a lot of kids from this area. I think it helps in the signing process, and we should know them better. I mean, if you look at the Atlanta Braves, for 10 years, their entire draft philosophy was based on taking high school kids from Atlanta. And you look at some of the, Brian McCann, Jason Hayward, you go on and on and on, the number of guys they took from that area. And the reason they took those kids was that they got to know them so well that they never missed on the makeup of those players. And that's the real advantage, is getting to know those kids personally over 3 or 4 years. And hopefully we can get to that point here where we know the San Diego area well enough to do that.
I was curious if some of the hitters that we drafted, or you drafted in the lower rounds this year, is there anybody you're really excited about? And who would you say is maybe the best pure power hitter that we selected in the draft?
Yeah, the one hitter that springs to mind is Kyle Gadell, that we took in the sixth round. Now, he was a guy that had been discussed before the year as kind of a first 50 to 75 type pick. Struggled, he had a very good last summer, struggled a little bit during his college season. But he's a guy that it's funny. His great uncle is Eddie Gadell, and he's actually the exact opposite. He's 6'4", great body. He can really run. So that was one of those picks that right when we made the pick, we were elated because in the sixth round to get that kind of physical talent is rare. We're hopeful that he goes back to hitting the way he did last summer. But he's probably the hitter, the kind of later round hitter that we're most excited about.
From what I have read in the paper, you guys have spent about half of the budget last year on the draft, and several of the top 15 went unsigned. Are you going to use part of the money saved last year for this year's draft?
Yes, that was one thing Tom and Jeff and I talked about a lot last year. We were very aggressive last year. We tried to sign a couple of high school kids late, for a lot of money. When that didn't happen, we rolled that money into this year's budget. I think we'll end up among the top spenders in baseball this year in the draft. Some of that's aggressive spending, aggressive budgeting, and some of that's going to be rolling the money over from last year.
I read recently that this organization had a lot more professional scouts as opposed to the last regime. Could you comment on why you felt the need to add more scouts, if you did, and what they brought to the draft, and also how you come about to know how many scouts you have in your organization? Like, what's the magic number?
Sure. Right now, when I got here, we had 11 area scouts and two cross-checkers, which was both the lowest in baseball. I think now we have 22 area scouts, and I think we have six cross-checkers, which is now probably in the top 10 or so in the game. Also, when I got here, I think we had three full-time professional scouts. Now we have a staff of, I think it's 11 or 12. Candidly, it was really, grossly understaffed before. There wasn't enough information on these players to make what I consider educated decisions. On the amateur side, there weren't enough looks at given players. Another thing that is a huge factor is that when you only have 11 area scouts, their areas are bigger, and therefore they're not able to get to know the kids quite as well. So, the more area scouts you have, it's not only about the scouting part, it's also about getting to know the kid's personality and being able to really assess that makeup. On the professional side, we just didn't have enough reports. When I got here, I was kind of shocked, frankly, by the number of times I'd look at a player for a trade and there'd be no reports for 2 years or not enough reports. And, I think that, the previous regime did a really good job of making those deals with very little information. That's not how I want to operate. I want to have a lot of information. And, Tom and Jeff were great and has, let me expand that staff. I hired A.J. Hinch. He's really, blown out that staff to a big number. Now we're going to have reports on every player, usually two or three reports on every minor league player during the year. So now when we go to make a deal, we're going to feel like we have enough information to make an educated decision. I think everyone talks about process, but when you make a trade for a minor league player without reports or without any video, it's hard to say the process was good. And I think that now that we can really feel like the process is going to be solid when we make those kind of deals.
I wondered what happened to the person whose mother had big bones. Did he? Was that a good choice or a bad choice?
It didn't work out well. It doesn't sound like from the
Now the other thing I wondered is how do you decide? You talked about high school and college. Now what about the international side? Where do they fit in? Even though I know they're not on the draft, where do you decide where they fit in?
Sure. Internationally, we have a fantastic facility in the Dominican Republic. We have a solid but not unbelievably large scouting budget down there, and part of that's strategic. When you look at the teams that have been most successful in the Dominican Republic, it's not the teams that spend $2-3 million on 16-year-old kids. Some of the best talent in the Dominican has come from lower signing bonuses. By far, the best team in baseball in the Dominican Republic is the Colorado Rockies. They've actually, frankly, struggled a little bit in the amateur draft, but they've made up for it by just player after player after player. They've been successful signing international guys, and they do it with $50,000, $100,000 signings. So the key down there is having good scouting and having a good process, not by signing a 16-year-old kid for $3 million because he had a good workout. And right now the international market has just gotten absolutely crazy. There's a lot of rumors that there's going to be a kid that signs for $5 million this year, a 16-year-old kid. I'm hopeful that in this next CBA, they've been talking about making an international draft. I think that would be the most fair thing, because I think that if you fix the amateur draft but you don't regulate international signings, then all that's going to happen is all that money is going to flow into the international market, which isn't a positive for anyone. So, and I feel very good about where we are internationally right now. But in general, I think that you just got to sign a lot of players internationally with our budget, develop them correctly, and sort of wait. And there's no magic formula. For example, I know there was a big splash when we opened the academy, and some of the players we signed,
you know, only now are those players starting to make an impact in Fort Wayne. And that was, I think, 3 years ago those players were signed, and now they're 19-year-old kids in Fort Wayne. So they're at least 3 more years away from contributing. So that's a 6-year investment to hope to get a payoff. And it's well worth it, but it's the kind of thing you have to spend and just wait. You know, you kind of take your eyes off them for a while, let them develop, and then hopefully when you check back in 3 years, they've developed. And that's really how I feel about the international market. As it relates to Cuba and Japanese players, I'm not saying never, but I think that the Cuban market has gotten so crazy. You know, the Rangers signed a kid this year for $15.5 million out of Cuba. And you know, that money, I could never sit down with Jeff and Tom and justify that kind of expenditure unless we just could pound the table. When Starlin Castro gets like $25,000, it's hard to justify that, you know, $15.5 million expenditure.
Let's hear your comment about the Rizzo effect. You brought him up, and thanks for doing that. I think it's been very exciting. How do you, as an organization, balance? I've heard you say in different radio interviews, you like the people were talking about him. There's a lot of pressure on you, I know, to call him up. You didn't really want to do it till you thought he was ready, and for whatever reasons you chose as an organization to make that timing decision. How do you, as an organization, get fans excited about the next Rizzo? How do we know who that is? How do you deal with that?
Sure. I hope there's a bunch of nights like we had on Thursday night. You know, it was, when I was in Boston, I've said it a couple times, like, we brought up, you know, John Lester, we brought up Clay Buchholz, you know, brought up Dustin Pedroia. Each one of those, Jacoby Ellsbury, each one of those guys, the fans were thrilled about. They'd heard about them all the way up through the system. They were excited. And, you know, I don't think there's been a night like we had Thursday night here for a while. You know, we need to have those almost on the annual basis. And when we get to that point, you know, kind of what I said before, then I think we'll feel really good about where we are as an organization. You know, I think Rizzo, the factors surrounding Rizzo are unique. You know, he was traded, he was in Adrian Gonzalez deal, so everyone knew his name. And then the performance he was having in AAA was otherworldly. So that really put him on everyone's radar screen. I don't think Brad Hopp's first 50 plate appearances did much to hurt that, you know. So I think it might be hard to create that kind of buzz all the time for, you know, whether, like, for example, if Jed Jerko continues to hit like this, you know, I'm not sure he's going to create the same buzz because he wasn't in an Adrian Gonzalez deal. But I'm hopeful that the fans will understand that each time we do that, you know, every time we bring up a top prospect is, you know, one step closer to getting that stable team where, you know, when you guys come to the, you know, the preseason, you know, forums or whatever, that you basically know the players are going to be out there, you know the positions, you know. My goal is to be able to have very quiet winters. You know, I think that, you know, I don't want to be out there, you know, making trades for half a lineup. I think that's that's something that we do while we're waiting for our farm system to contribute. And it's not the greatest way to have to run an organization. Once we get to the point where, you know, our lineup is stable because we have good young players at all the positions, my life's a lot easier and your life's a lot better. So I'm looking forward to that.
Okay, back to local talent. I'm wondering if you're keeping an eye on the Parkview Little League players as they're going through high school.
Yeah, exactly. I try to keep my eye on a lot of players. I can't say those guys are on my watch list quite yet, but they will be soon enough. And like I said before, the last couple of years in San Diego haven't been the best years, but I do anticipate a lot of years where, you know, the guys we're most focused on are down here, and I think that's a great thing. I think that, you know, I mean, using Adrian as an example, I know he was, you know, drafted and you know, by the Marlins and then traded twice, but you know, having a local player that everyone loves to watch, I think, is a great thing. And you know, getting back to that point where we have some local players that everyone's excited about, I think is a great result, and hopefully something we can have at some point. Take Ali as well.
Jed, if I may, segue off of Tom's comment on the big-boned mothers of prospective players.
Yeah.
Is there a change in focus on a scout's part or when you're drafting on your part if the player already has a known baseball lineage, already comes from a family of baseball players?
That's a good question. You know, it's something that in every scouting report like that, you always see, you know, the, you know, good bloodlines or things like that, like you're talking about a horse, you know, but it's like, I think when it comes to players of major league parents, I think it's a big positive. Those kids have grown up around the game. They get used to being in the clubhouse. They know the lifestyle. As an example, I'll use Casey Kelly is probably a pretty good example of that. You know, his dad played in the big leagues. His dad was a minor league coach his entire childhood, and his comfort level in a major league clubhouse is remarkable. You know, when we sent him out this year at the end of spring training, you know, most kids sort of put their tail between their legs and walk out of the office. He actually controlled the meeting and was asking questions about his mechanics and what he can do to improve and, you know, what we didn't like from him in spring training. And it was, you kind of walked out of the room and were like, that was a very different meeting. And I think it comes from being around the game and not being intimidated by your surroundings. And so when it comes to, you know, players with major league parents, I think there's always a slight edge or a slight positive. You know, I think with the example of, you know, Joe Ross, I think the fact that his brother's in the big leagues is a positive. I think that you can assume that he's learned a fair amount from him, and he talks to him, and I think that, you know, that goes a long way. I think even this having a baseball family, having, you know, if your dad's a high school coach or a college coach, or, you know, the kids that really grew up around the game, you have to play. I mean, you're going to get, you know, 500 or 600 innings in the minor leagues. You're going to get, you know, 2,000 plus play appearances in the minor leagues, and a lot of really bad bus rides, and a lot of low pay. And, you know, I was just talking to Dave Roberts last night about some of the minor league, you know, the grind of the minor leagues. And what it really comes down to, in my opinion, is how much you love baseball and how much you're willing to sacrifice, you know, for it. Because there's going to be moments in every player's minor league career where, you know, the pay and the travel and the grind of it is overwhelming, and then the guys that are willing to fight through that are the ones that survive it. So the love of the game is something we focus on a lot in the draft, and, you know, when you have parents or brothers that went through it, there's a pretty safe bet that you're willing to go through that same sacrifice.
Hi there. I would like to ask a couple questions, put you guys on the hot seat. So we had a ball club last year that played beautifully. And you got rid of most of the players, and including David Eckstein. And he was the fire that was lit in the last 2 years of this ball club. And so now we have a ball club that half of the team is hitting less than 200. And when do you think that these draft picks are going to be ready to come up? Is it going to be next year? Is it going to be 3 years from now? And when it is it time to now trade Rizzo? And Tom, I have a question for you, and that is, when are we getting the All-Star game? Thank you.
You know, that's a great question on, you know, about last year. And I think, and when I look at last year, you know, everything came together beautifully for that team. You know, I think it's hard to argue that that team had was an immensely talented team. I think we all year kind of fought against all odds to win games. And I think that's a huge positive, that we were kind of a little engine that could. And, you know, when I look at the players on that team, whether it was John Garland or Torrey Alba or Hairston, you know, both Hairstons, David Eckstein, you know, candidly, I look at what those players are doing this year, like every one of those guys is struggling mightily. You know, last year that group had a great bond. They played incredibly well. This year, you know, when they've gone their different ways, they've all struggled. So, you know, I think it's a good question, and I think that, you know, wondering if that team, if we brought back the exact same team, if they would have had the same results, I think it's something that we'll never know, but it's something you can ask. Personally, I don't believe that you can sort of recapture magic from year to year. I think that last year's team, everything came together beautifully for it. I think that, you know, David Eckstein was a factor in that, but I also think that it's unfair to sort of make him the personification of that, because I think that that would be taking away from Adrian, you know, from Torrey Alba, from Jerry Hairston, from a lot of players that also contributed to what happened. So, you know, that was a hard decision. We end up with a lot with draft picks because of that. Candidly, we couldn't have afforded to bring that team back as it was. It would have cost us over $60 million to bring that same team back. So we had to make some hard decisions. So I think that I like a lot of things about this team. You know, it hasn't had that same magic that last year's team did. I'm hopeful that we can find it. But I think that, you know, kind of what I just answered, a question I answered earlier, I think that, you know, we need to get to a point as an organization where, you know, we're not needing to turn over the roster, that we're able to bring up young players time after time. And when we do that, we don't want to get rid of those young players. And I think that your point about Rizzo, I think, is something that we want to avoid, that we want to be able to, you know, bring up these young players, sign them to long-term deals, and know that you're going to be watching the same team over and over. The more we have to, more I have to spend last offseason bringing in two Harrisons and Torrey Alba and, you know, John Garland, doing all those things, and then the same thing this year, you know, we're doing that because our farm system's not contributing enough. Once we get to the point where our farm system's contributing enough, we want to keep those players, and then that's really our main focus. So your question about Rizzo, we certainly hope that he's our first baseman here for a long time, and that, you know, you come in every year knowing that he, not only is he going to be our first baseman, but you're going to know who's going to be playing other positions as well.
We probably have time for about two more questions. I know we have one in the first row, and just as a heads up, though. Just
I need to answer the All-Star question first.
Yep.
That's a great question. I think it, for whatever reason in the past, it hadn't been prioritized with the leadership here, that you have to ask for the All-Star game, and then you have to politically lobby hard for it. And it hadn't been really prioritized here in the past. I know that for Jeff and I, it is a priority and something that we're asking for. I think the earliest you'll see it is 2015, more likely 2017 if we're able to get it then. The challenge that we do have now is there are several National League teams asking for it, many of whom have new ballparks, albeit, you know, we should be in the queue before them. But we are asking for it, we are lobbying for it, and we will get one here. When, I'm not sure, but we will get one here because it is a priority of ours.
Of the high school kids that are drafted right out of high school, how many of those are redrafted when they complete their college thing? Or what kind of a death rate do they have?
They get a good education. They don't die. But we've never actually, you know, tracked exactly what the percentage is. I can tell you that almost every high college player that's in the draft turned down a signing bonus to go to college. So usually when you see, I'm trying to think of a good example we have, but usually you'll see, like, you know, drafted 17th round by so-and-so out of high school, and then they turned it down. So, you know, for the most part, I think that the players that go to college, they end up, you know, progressing as players and getting drafted again. I think that the players that get drafted in the first couple rounds, the signing bonuses are high enough that it's hard for them to justify going to college and turning down, you know, well north of $1 million. A handful of those guys do it. Garrett Cole is a good example. He was a first-round pick by the Yankees out of high school, went to UCLA, and he was the first pick in the draft this year. So there's certainly some success stories. But I would say for the most part, you know, most of the guys that are drafted end up getting drafted again. But they may turn down a decent amount of money in order to have that 3 years of college.
That was sort of basically my question, and I guess, do you shy away from high school students that are great baseball players that are heavily committed to a university? I know Austin Hedges is not one of them, but...
Yeah, somewhat. I mean, I think that's where your area scouts have to do a very good job of figuring out exactly what that individual student's motivation is. For some of them, their motivation is simply having leverage to get a higher signing bonus. And then you figure out that this kid's not going to college. He's just going to use the leverage point to get more money, which is, it's a fair, you know, business position. You know, for other kids, it's really clear that they want the education. And for a kid that age, the area scouts need to do a very good job of getting to figure out what the parents want, mostly the mother. Yeah, depending on our bones, yeah. Yeah. But, you know, that was something, you know, that was something we learned, you know, last year. A.J. Venegas, we took in the seventh round. We tried exceptionally hard to sign him. We offered him very, you know, a high first-round signing bonus to sign. At the end of the day, his parents really wanted him to go to Stanford. The dad had gone to Stanford. I think he had grown up wanting to play for Stanford, and that won out. Had the kid made that decision, he would have certainly signed. And so the area scouts have to do a good job of figuring out what the motivation in the house is, whether or not it's, you know, if the parents are adamant that the kid's going to go to college, you're probably not going to do much to change their mind.
Well, you have, like, probably 25 of the 49 kids here from high school.
Sure.
Do you think that you're going to be able to sign the majority of them, or most of them are going to go to college, or most of them are not committed?
Yeah.
Are a lot of these students committed?
I guess I would say this. Oh, they're all committed. I mean, all these kids have scholarships. I guess I would say this, that I'm very confident that the ones we really want to sign, we're going to sign. Like I answered before, I think there's a fair number of kids near here at the end that, you know, we drafted. We'll watch them this summer. If we don't sign some of those kids, that's fine. But the ones at the top of the draft that we want to sign, we're very confident that we'll sign.
We're excited.
Good. Jed, Tom, thank you for your time today. I know everybody appreciates it.
Thanks, guys.
And thank you, all of you, our season ticket holders. Thank you very much. I know Tom's words rang home with you, how special you are, and that you're the fact that you are our most loyal fan. So we appreciate you and the commitment that you and your families make to being season ticket holders with us. Our service team is going to stick around if you haven't had a chance to meet us.